All right. And we're back. What's going on? It's April 2nd. This is the QTR podcast. I've been gone for a couple of weeks. I took a couple weeks off. I actually had a podcast scheduled like a week or two ago, but the dude canceled on me at the last minute. I'm not going to call out his name, but let's just say I wasn't feeling motivated to replace the guest. I was going to do an Our Bullshit Economy episode, to be honest with you. And then I wound up having a drink and then just like milling around the city that day, the day I was supposed to do it. And I just kind of forgot. And I was like, you know what? I had Mark DeFont booked for today. We had prepared this one in advance. I was like, I'm just going to use the time to prepare for this podcast. And of course, everybody that listens to me knows that's a lie. I don't prepare at all. Basically, I just fucked off for like 3 weeks. It's been great. Hello. Thank you to my sponsors who continue to support the podcast despite the fact that I just don't feel like doing shit sometimes. I want to shout them out first. My patrons, people that sign up and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. First and foremost, my friends over at JM Bullion. JM Bullion is the only place that I buy my gold and silver bullion from. They ship my orders quickly. They turn my orders around quickly. They always have great inventory. And they've been a huge supporter of the podcast for a while. So if you like me and you like gold and silver, why not go to JM Bullion and spread the love around amongst like the three people in the industry that I can tolerate? And JM Bullion is one of them. The other two also happen to be sponsors. But anyways, JM Bullion, there is a dedicated salesperson there to help with QTR podcast listeners if you don't feel like navigating the website or if you have questions about buying gold and silver bullion like I did the first time. Like, what do? You just fucking mail it? Yeah, well, the answer is yes. You can email the lovely Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at jmbullion.com. She would be happy to help you with any and all of your inquiries. And that about does it for JM Bullion. I love those guys. Longtime supporters of the podcast, and the links are in my podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at the Sanlucci Steam Room. The Steam Room is now about a 10-year work in progress. I think the Steam Room has been around for almost a decade now. The original piece of software that was there to help track unusual options activity before everybody was adding unusual options activity to whatever bullshit service they're trying to offer you. Sanlucci and Wall Street Jesus were the first to do it. Nobody was doing it before them. Nobody. What is he saying? Jay and Silent Bob, strike back. None of you little fucks. Nobody does it like Sanlucci and Wall Street Jesus. Hey, the Steam Room is a wonderful piece of software that they have kept up with. And I would, in my opinion, I would say is industry leading. I would say that nobody knows how to track unusual options activity. And nobody's been tracking flow for a living quite like Lucci. In addition to all the other shit he knows, I mean, Lucci and Wall Street Jesus have been in the game for a long time. They've had their ups. They've had their downs. It's actually probably time to have Sanlucci back on the podcast, speaking of which. Speaking of low points for him. But the Steam Room, wonderful piece of software. They'll let you try it for free. The link to that is in my podcast description. I can't recommend these guys enough. Another person I can't recommend enough is George Gammon and his platform, Rebel Capitalist Pro, also longtime supporters of the podcast. George has teamed up with Chris McIntosh, Lynn Alden, Brent Johnson, and a whole host of other people that wear nice suits and understand what they're talking about. These are the people who I listen to when I go and want to listen to a podcast. Obviously, I'm sick of hearing myself talk, which is why I can't bring myself to do a podcast more than once every 3 weeks. But aside from that, I enjoy listening to, you know, guys like Brent Johnson and George Gammon try to hash shit out. They're really smart. They understand the out-of-control world of central banks, and their goal is to help you understand it the way that they do in hopes that you can hopefully preserve your wealth. Although, if Klaus Schwab has anything to say about it, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. I'd like to have a word with that fucking guy, by the way. Anyways, so Rebel Capitalist Pro is a wonderful offering. It includes a forum for you to go on, shoot the shit with other like-minded individuals. They do live Q&As. It's worth the money. George is a great guy. George, Lucci, JM Bullion, all these guys are honest people to do business with. They will give you free trials and whatever you want. Just tell them QTR sent you. Not whatever you want, obviously, but they'll work with you. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Doomberg. The Doomberg Substack, flying past my Substack at 22.7 trillion miles an hour on the Substack highway. Much smarter content than mine. Many more subscribers than mine. I go on and I read their articles. By the way, I love their articles. The Doomberg Substack is 100% free. It is economics through a skeptical Austrian-style lens, the same way that we look at it. But fuck, man, I love these guys. I really do. The collective that writes for them, I think that they're very intelligent. I enjoy their reading. It's snarky. It's funny. And it's spot on, most importantly. But I go on there and I read, and you know, they post something, and it's like 12 minutes later, they have 672 comments. So I'm like, holy shit. You know, and I go back over to my clunky blog, you know, my post for the day, my thoughts on a Monday by Chris Irons, you know, one like, zero comments. And I'm like, oh man, fuck me. Can I get like one of you guys to come over and comment on my shit? Jesus Christ. Anyways, I guess the point is that Doomberg is a wonderful Substack to read, and that's why everybody's going there. So I would recommend subscribing to them and not subscribing to my Substack, and the link to that's in my podcast description. What do you think about that? This podcast also brought to you by some of my longest-running patrons, like Max Mulvihill, who said what's up to me on Twitter the other day. Fucking Max, after 4 years... By the way, he was my first patron on the podcast. Sent me a message yesterday. Like, dude, you should do a daily show. I would pay extra for a daily show. I'm like, Max, hey, man, we all love you, dude. You know, I love you to death. You were the first guy to ever be a patron on my podcast. But listen, I'm not that good. I mean, the content is okay. Maybe it's interesting, but I can't do a fucking daily show. I get sick of hearing myself doing one podcast every 3 weeks. But Max, goddamn if I don't appreciate your excitement, man. Just keeping my... Keeping the pulse of my ego just barely, you know, above a flat line. So I guess that's all I really want to shout out is Max Mulvihill today. Thanks, dude. What's going on? First guy to ever fucking support my podcast financially in 2018. Max Mulvihill. Did I say Max Mulvihill yet? Okay, we have Mark DeFont on today. I'm so happy.
What would you like to talk about first? Oh, sorry.
I'm like, dude, you ready? You're like, yep. I'm like, all right, I'm so happy. We both started talking
my
at
apologies.
The same time. What do you want to talk
Can
about
I
first?
Can I ask you one question?
Yeah, sure.
What do you want to talk about first? Where do you want me to go with this?
Well, I don't know. I guess we'll figure it out when we get there. How's that sound?
All right. Just play it by ear then.
Okay. All right. All right. So that's what usually the prior to the podcast conversation starts like it's a, except we're putting it on the recording for this one because who no one really cares. All right, my friend Mark DeFont is here, Dr. Mark DeFont, who I haven't talked to in a couple of months. I first started talking to Dr. Mark DeFont maybe a year or two ago now, at least. I saw him on the Joe Rogan Experience debunking Graham Hancock at one point, and I was like, man, this guy should have his own episode. I really liked listening to what he had to say. He's a professor of geology and geochemistry at the University of South Florida. I can't believe you still have your job after numerous appearances on this podcast, Mark, but that's remains to be seen. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about the world of oil and gas, which I am excited about because I haven't really talked about that with anybody, and I think there's a lot of... I think you bring a lot to the table in terms of helping people understand exactly what the hell is going on in the oil market right now. You have experience. You worked for Schlumberger Well Services, yes, and Shell Oil for 3 years, with 2 of your years at Shell working as an exploration geologist. You've been funded by the National Science Foundation, National Geographic, the American Chemical Society, and the National Academy of the Sciences, and you've published... in many international renowned scientific journals, including Nature, alongside of my articles, of course, in Nature. Right, Mark? How are you?
Yes, of course. I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm great. I can't believe it's taken this long to have you back on. I don't like that.
Well, we'll have to do something about that. I always enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, that feeling is definitely mutual. I think... You know, since the last time you've been on, all hell has broken loose yet again.
No kidding.
And I guess the best place to start, here's what I want to cover right off the bat, is, look, the price of oil has gone batshit insane over the last 6 months, the last 3 months especially. You know, the bid in commodities had started a little bit prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And it had started, you know, as part of a consequence of our domestic energy policy and the amount of dollars that we're creating out of thin air. People coming out of the pandemic with money in their pockets, starting to drive their trucks and their cars again. And the Biden administration pretty much not motivating oil and gas companies to bring new supply online. So there was a little bit of a tailwind heading into this crisis here with Russia. But now, in addition to that, you have kind of a perfect storm for anybody that was long oil, because Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the subsequent sanctions that the West and Europe have tried to put into place on Russia include, energy sanctions, and include, the consideration of not purchasing Russian oil, which makes up, you know, I think 10% of the oil that we use here in the U.S. I'm just ballparking, but it's a considerable amount. So we have kind of a perfect storm, and oil prices have gone from, you know, negative $30 a barrel in April 2020, which literally meant, you know, they would give you $30,000 and 1,000 barrels of oil, or whatever the futures contract says. Like, we'll pay you $30,000 and give you 1,000 barrels of oil if you can take delivery of it, because there was nowhere to put the shit, to oil being at $130 a barrel, which is, you know, of course, the total opposite end of the spectrum, heading towards all-time highs. Now, Mark, you wrote to me a month ago saying, look, I think the public really doesn't understand the role that the Biden administration is playing in the price of oil. And I wanted you to explain your take for people that are just starting to wrap their heads around this situation and may not know oil and gas like a seasoned trader or a geologist.
Well, first of all, let me just say that I think probably a lot of your audience is economically savvy. So I was hoping to bring to you a little bit of my limited knowledge of the oil industry. I'm not an expert on it, but I do have, having worked for the various companies in the oil industry, I do have a little bit of knowledge, and I've certainly tried to keep up with what's been going on in the oil industry. And I think before I go further, let me just say that gas was up 40% and oil was up 80% before the Ukrainian war started. And I think what got me a little incensed is the fact that Biden has been going around saying, oh, the price of gasoline is due to Putin.
Right.
It's kind of an outrageous lie. The you know, inflation was up around 6, maybe even as high as 6.5% before the war in Ukraine. And I think we all know that's probably due to printing of so much money under his administration. But I don't want to I want to be critical of some of the misrepresentation Biden is doing and trying to understand why it's wrong for him to be saying some of these things. So maybe I'll start out with just giving you a little bit of information on what's happened to push the oil prices up. And most of it is totally unrelated to the war in Ukraine. It's true that we have, in theory, stopped buying Russian oil. But of course, the Russians love that in the sense that they can get rid of their oil now at a higher price, partly due to the fact that the oil supply in the markets is less than it has been in the past. So, and can you imagine? You said a negative $30 per barrel. All that oil during COVID, because the people wouldn't, work to have that oil be brought off of ships. You know, they had to give it away. It's kind of an amazing thing. Now we elect a president and we're paying astronomical amounts at the pump. You know,
You can say one thing about Trump, you know, and certainly you can be critical of his past business dealings and the way he does business, stiffing vendors and things like that, things that I don't approve of. But, you got to give them credit for refilling the strategic petroleum reserve with oil when the price was that low. I mean, he's kind of a simple guy, Trump. You know, he knows when prices are very, very low. Like George Gammon always says, I like to buy things when they're cheap and sell them when they're expensive. You know, at least he knew
then.
Kind of smart. Yeah, at least he knew then. Yeah, what the fuck? We'll fill up the strategic petroleum reserve. You know, they're looking for a place to put the. There was literally nowhere to put the oil. There was so much of it at that point. I remember reading about it, wondering how the price could do that. You know, what would cause a price to go negative? It was the idea that you had to take delivery. They were coming up on a delivery date for that contract, and there was literally nowhere to put it.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And I think it would be good to talk a little bit more about that. They're saying right now that the average family in America can expect to pay an extra $5,200 because of the rise in oil prices. For some people, I mean, that's the difference between food on the table and no food on the table. So, it's becoming a crisis, and yet Biden doesn't seem to be taking the steps to mitigate this major problem. And I don't want to give your audience the idea that I'm a big Trumper guy. I honestly think Trump acts like an asshole quite a bit of the time, but at the end of the day, he seems to have the country in his best interest, and I was willing to put up with that. I wouldn't want to see Trump nominated again just because of all of the turmoil he creates.
Divisiveness,
by
right.
The things. Yeah, right. But if he's nominated, and I've got Trump or Biden, oh, good Lord, I'm going to go Trump every time, because I really think – Biden is literally destroying the U.S. economy, trying to get to net zero oil pollution. And he's been seemingly bought by radical green people. I consider myself an environmentalist, but not a radical environmentalist. I think we do have global warming, but I'm not willing to destroy the economy in order to do some of the crazy things they're trying to do. We're supposed to go to net zero pollution of carbon dioxide while the rest of the world is burning it as fast as they can. China, India, there's no restrictions that they're putting on themselves. If we do it, we're just being foolish and losing out to these other countries that are still burning coal at massive amounts. Right. At least we've changed our coal to gas, which is much cleaner to burn than coal. Coal has a complex carbon compounds in it, and so it can produce a lot more carbon dioxide than methane, which only has one carbon in it. So when you burn a methane, you're not getting the carbon dioxide pollution that you are with coal. So we've reduced, in fact, we've reduced our carbon imprint by the largest amount of any country in the world over the last 10 years or so. So I think we need a pat on the back for that.
But Mark, it's not zero. You know, that's the problem. The problem is that the people on the left, they're obsessed with the number zero, you know,
correct.
And come hell or high water, no matter what it means, no matter how we have to get there, the ends are always going to justify them. Never mind the fact that, you know, net zero carbon emissions, you know, from a practical standpoint, getting there is going to be extraordinarily difficult. It can be done over a long amount of time, but to set that as the waypoint and then expect the economy and people's quality of life and, you know, the infrastructure of society as we know it to just change because here's where you want to end up is insane. You know, it's akin to President Numbnuts here, who is trying to address the oil problem by doing what? By, you know, releasing our strategic petroleum reserves, which are supposed to be there really in the event of a military crisis, to the best of my understanding. They amount to a droplet in an ocean of oil. They're not going to make a considerable difference on the price of oil. You know, instead of just bringing more oil and gas online, which is the obvious solution when you have a supply and demand problem and you need more supply or you need less demand, you know, and now he's talking about price controls. Right. And he's got people like Elizabeth Warren saying that, oh, you know, that the oil and gas companies are just gouging people. And that's why, you know, the price of oil, as if supply and demand didn't exist, you know, as if the, you know, talk about just addressing the, just addressing a problem in a fashion that gets you nowhere. It's completely counterintuitive. And that's exactly, it's exactly what we're talking about here with net zero carbon emissions, right? You're kind of creating a big evil boogeyman where there isn't one and telling people that, you know, it has to be addressed within a certain amount of time and through certain methods. And meanwhile, it doesn't matter what the collateral damage is, right?
Yeah, just to give you some numbers on that, the Bank of America estimates it'll cost America, and this is a number I can't even get my head around, $150 trillion over 30 years to go to net zero emissions. That's a $5 trillion each year to get there. I don't know an economy in the world that could do that and not have a major crisis. And we and Europe seem to be the only countries interested in doing this. So how do you, you know, how can you stop or reverse any global warming that may exist when we're the practically the only country in the world willing to even try this? We've seen how Germany has failed. I mean, now Germany's completely dependent on Russian oil because they've tried to go to net zero, and they realized that they, you know, if they are going to do it, it's going to take a long time and it's going to be very expensive. So, and then I don't know where, you know, I read a lot of the literature on global warming, and for AOC to come out and say, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago, that the world was going to end in 12 years. Well, that's just hysterical craziness. I don't know where that hysteria comes from. There's nothing that would indicate.
Well, I do.
In 12
it,
years.
It comes from a gross ignorance of
yes.
the reality of things, mixed with a emotional hysteria.
Yes.
And a feeling of entitlement and arrogance and all those things kind of put into a blender. And that's what you get. You get, you know, a completely grossly misinformed member of Congress, you know, making hysterical claims that unfortunately half the country believes.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I couldn't agree with you more. So that's why I wanted to talk a little bit about what's being done here and why it seems so crazy to me. And I'd like to start out just briefly talking about fracking. Of course, as you know, fracking has been extremely controversial with the left and the radical environmentalists. So maybe this is something that's new to your audience, but we have been decreasing in oil production since a peak around 1984, and oil production in the United States has decreased significantly up until, I guess around 2008. So then in 2008, we went from a so-so producer to the world's number one producer. Not only were we producing more oil than any country in the world, we were producing astronomical amounts of oil compared to the biggest producers like Russia and Saudi Arabia. And so the obvious question is, why were we able to do that? And the answer is basically fracking. And in 1997, I won't go into the details, but a small company had a geologist there that had talked the company into using a non-viscous, primarily water, to pressure up the hole to be able to fracture oil shale. Now, I should say that oil shale contains an immense amount of oil in it compared to, say, sandstone. The difference is that oil shales are very, very impermeable. In other words, the void spaces in the shale are not connected, so the oil doesn't flow out. So what they were able to do was go in and pressurize the wells so that it was a S.H. Griffin number 4 well that they did this on, and a guy named Nick Steinsberger, if you're interested in details like that, was the one that got Mitchell Energy to try and frack this oil well. And what they do is they pressurize the well with water and sand, and this water will fracture the shale, and those little sand particles that they send out into the shale will keep the shale open so that the oil can flow. And this has never been successfully done until 1997, when Mitchell Energy tried it in Texas. And sure enough, they got oil to flow. Of course, Mitchell Energy wanted to keep the information proprietary, but the word got out, and by 2008, most U.S. companies knew how to frack. And so if you look at a chart of oil production, I wish I could show you this, but by 2019, we were producing about 17,000 barrels per day of oil, compared to let's say Saudi Arabia, which was below 12,000, and Russia also right up there, but below 12,000. So we were producing astronomical amounts of oil, and why? Because of American technology. Now, of course, what did the environmentalists do? Did they say, wow, we're no longer dependent on Arab oil. We're no longer dependent on the Russians. What they turned around and said was, oh, no, this is hurting the environment. Fracking is terrible. And they used all of the early mistakes when the licensing and permitting hadn't caught up with the process of fracking. So they used all of that to try to stop fracking. In fact, New York State would not allow fracking, still doesn't allow fracking in the state. And imagine the revenue that they're losing because they won't allow fracking to go on. If you wonder why taxes are high in New York, that's one of the reasons. And so what did the environmentalists do? They focused on a couple of places where it's true they actually had gas coming out of faucets in certain areas, and they could light their water on fire. So it's not a good look. And those companies were sued, went out of business, and the government came in and made sure that they cemented the pipes correctly. Now, when you drill a oil well, you have to cement. They put a casing in which protects the well from any products getting into the aquifer. So, and they're very careful about this. They drill with a mud base, which you could actually eat. It's so clean, and it goes. So if any gets into the aquifer through a leak or something, it won't pollute it. That casing goes in, and then they cement that casing before they drill deeper. And we know where the aquifers are. They're between about 300 feet and 5,000 feet, depending on where you're drilling. So, you know, the government comes in and protects those aquifers and makes sure they're protected. And then they can't start drilling deeper until they've tested it. Well, in the early days of fracking, I think there were some shoddy companies going out there, and they allowed their cementing not to be done to the permitting levels. Now, of course, all that's changed. You don't see any water being burned as it comes out of the faucet like you did back in the late 1990s. And then, of course, there was the earthquake problem. A lot of people think that the process of fracking causes earthquakes. That's not true at all. What they were doing was, there's a lot of water that's used when you frack a well. Remember, you have to actually break that shale up through great pressure, and that takes a lot of water. And between 50% and 50% of the water you put down the hole will come back up before the oil starts to produce. And so the fracking companies didn't know what to do with all that oil. It's fairly clean, but about 0.05% of it has some pretty nasty chemicals in it. So they couldn't just, you know, put it in a pond somewhere. So they came up with a fairly ingenious idea. They decided that they would pump it down old oil wells that weren't producing, which isn't a bad idea. The only problem was that water, when it got deep, it slicked up faults below the surface, and that's where we got those earthquakes. They weren't terrible earthquakes. It's not going to be a bringing down an entire city kind of earthquakes. They're slightly above 3 on the Richter scale. In 2008, we had only about 867 earthquakes in the Midwest, and then somewhere around 2015, there were upwards of 3,800 earthquakes. So all they did was they said you can't send the water down old wells because it creates all of this all of these earthquakes. And so they started, and they should have been doing this in the first place, they started reusing the water, cleaning the water up and then reusing it. So it's become a very environmental friendly now. The earthquakes have dropped to pre-2008 levels now in the Midwest, and the problem has dissipated. And another big argument, I just saw something by the Sierra Club, they're still saying that there's a great amount of leaking from fracking. That's simply not true. In fact, the Environmental Protection Agency went in and did a huge study in cooperation with the United States Geological Survey to determine all of the problems with fracking and how they could be fixed. And the EPA now, gave a blessing to the fracking industry because they weren't having leaks. They had cut down on the earthquakes, and of course, no methane was coming out of water faucets because they made sure that they had proper casing set up. So if you look at methane and the leakage problem, it's non-existent. There is no methane. And of course, oil companies don't want to lose their methane. That's what they sell. So they're not going to have leaks in it. If you've created a leak in the system, you're probably going to be fired for it because it's precious to the oil companies to keep that methane.
Yeah, so nobody's just letting it, go and saying, okay, yeah, this is fine. Yeah, we like the fire coming out of the faucet.
And here's the crazy thing. They're complaining about methane, but the increase that we've had of methane production due to fracking, also increase in oil, gas and oil both went up. And of course, you make gasoline from oil. So the more oil we can produce, the more gasoline we'll have. So it's just crazy to me that they want to shut down fracking, which is very clean, and pay Arabs and no offense, but Middle Eastern countries or Russia or whomever and be dependent on them. It just seems insane to me.
You don't have to say no offense. There are Arab people in the Middle East.
Well, that's true.
They are paying Arabs.
That's right.
So you don't. There's no need to say no offense there. That's just the truth.
I think that when I say Arab, I don't mean it in a racially offensive way. What I say is that I think many Arab countries are part of a cartel called OPEC, and they've tried to control the price of oil for years. The America, when they started becoming the number one producer of oil and gas, they were able to now control the price of oil. We even started to export oil before Biden came in as president.
That's right.
So here we are, a country exporting our oil. By the way, all that oil in Europe is coming from Russia. Germany is heavily dependent on oil. And so we could be supplying not only ourselves with oil and gas, but we could be helping Europe get off of Russian oil.
It's just insane. And then Biden comes out and is making these speeches to people saying, hey, you know, you guys got to take one for the team here because we're all trying to stick it to Putin together. Right. You know, you guys. I know gas is $7 a gallon, but hey, you know, everybody's got to do their part here in fighting Russia. You know, it's like, dickhead, you have to do your part. You know, like, bring oil and gas on the, you know, people don't even understand what natural gas is. They know that fracking sounds bad. Okay. They don't know what it is. They know that it sounds bad. It's just like oil and gas in general, Mark. I mean, look, you have a unique perspective on this because you're a geologist and you've worked in the industry. I have probably a little bit of a different perspective because I worked with hydrocarbons also. You know, I had a job where we took, you know, straight chain hydrocarbons and we tried to break them down into, you know, crude oil, which we actually had some success doing. But, you know, I'm familiar kind of, you know.
So you worked in cracking.
Yeah.
Tried to crack.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Pyrolysis. We were doing catalytic cracking in the absence of oxygen. So, you know, and we were using aliphatics. We were using, you know, just friendly, non-toxic, you know, types of plastic, polyethylene, high-density polyethylene mainly, and you know, cracking the hydrocarbon chains and then working to reassemble them in ways where they could be used in a manner that was cost efficient, which nobody is really doing. It's, you know, kind of a interesting link in the plastic sustainability cycle that nobody really has addressed. But anyways, in doing that, you know, you learn a lot about, you know, I wasn't a chemist for the company. I worked, you know, doing investor relations and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But you learn a lot about the organic chemistry behind
it. Oh, I bet you do.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you learn, you know, the different, you know, friendly types of plastics and the less friendly types of plastics, you know, the things you don't want to crack, like PVC, and things like that. And you start to see the world of, you know, and we were outputting like number two diesel fuel. We were outputting naphtha, and you look to see it, how some of these fuels are used, and you learn about the petroleum industry and, you know, even just the basics, like something like your laundry detergent bottle is probably high density polyethylene, which is probably made out of, you know, a friendly type of plastic made from hydrocarbons. And most people don't even understand that. They don't understand the link between the oil and gas industry and petroleum and how it plays a role in their lives on a daily basis. They just think smokestacks, fucking, you know, oil spills, Exxon Valdez, ducks covered in oil, you know, killing seals, you know,
yes.
I don't know what these, what the environmentalists think, but they're only seeing one side of the equation, you know, and then they're getting back into their cars, you know, which are made with PVC and are made with rubber and, you know, and they're driving around and conducting the rest of their life using plastics that are all made from hydrocarbons and they don't really get it. So it's a like very broad misunderstanding of the industry in general. I'm not saying that we shouldn't wean ourselves off of oil and gas eventually and towards cleaner options, because there are cleaner options. But I am saying that most people don't understand what the oil and gas industry is, how it plays a role in their lives. And when you talk about something like natural gas, you know, like in the grand scheme of things, if we can come up with an abundance of, you know, natural gas to help reduce our energy dependence on Russia and on foreign nations, which is what you're talking about, you know, natural gas is relatively clean, you know, when you compare
it's extremely clean.
and so it is absurd for, you know, it's like you have to meet in the middle somewhere, right? You can't flick the switch and send the nation onto wind power overnight. You know, it's a lovely thought, right? But it's just, it's completely impractical. And so there,
and where do we buy all that from? China. We buy all that wind stuff. And anyway, don't get me started. Solar energy, all made by China. I think 80% of all of that is made in China. So we're basically destroying our economy and giving it to China. Excuse me for interrupting.
No, it's, you're the guest. You know, it's good that you interrupt. Otherwise,
well, I couldn't agree with you more. Nobody. I mean, almost anything you can think of in your home that has carbon in it was made from petroleum.
Exactly.
So, your point is very well taken. I mean, I know that we want to cut back, but I just don't think reducing carbon dioxide output is anything that's going to be done by everybody in the world. And so we're going to have to do alternative types of energy, not just from solar or from wind, but also, I'll talk a little bit more about this later, but probably we're going to need to go to something like nuclear energy. But I wanted to also throw in there, you know, Biden seems to me to contradict himself so much. He okayed the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, but the first thing he did when he got into office was shut down the XL pipeline. I don't get it. How come it's okay to have a pipeline in Russia going to Germany and not have one coming from Canada? Do you know, because we don't have the XL pipeline, by the way, we'd almost be finished with it now if he hadn't shut it down. We're bringing all of our oil. It hasn't stopped oil flowing from Canada. It's just more expensive to bring it to us. So we have to now ship it on trains instead of through a pipeline. And of course, you probably are aware, as well as your audience, that we've had a number of train wrecks recently. And I literally mean train wrecks, where the oil being carried in these trains has exploded or spilled or, you know, contaminated towns. And we're still doing that. And with the demand of oil, we need to do a lot more to get that oil down there. Whereas a pipeline is a pretty safe way to get oil from one place to the other. And that's what people don't understand.
A hell of a lot more efficiently. You know, it's the difference between,
that's what I mean.
It's the difference between doing your dishes and, you know, having to walk across the room with, you know, with a thimble and, you know, filling the thimble up with water and then walking it back across the room to dump a, you know, a tiny little, you know, quarter cup of water onto one dish and then scrubbing away at it versus having a faucet that you can just turn on.
It's
an enormous difference when you think about how much oil we use and we're dependent on, regardless of, you know, how much we want to wean ourselves off of it. There's always, I mean, the amount that we are dependent on is monstrous. And to think about shipping that in rail cars is just,
no kidding,
it's ridiculous. And by the way, you know, something has to power the fucking trains to make the it's a horrifically inefficient way to do things.
So if you're wondering why oil and gas is costing so much, just think about how the government is trying to stop the production of cheap energy in the United States. The Keystone Pipeline, if that was, you know, anywhere near ready by now, we could, you know, we could have that infrastructure there. That, let me give you some interesting numbers here. Our strategic petroleum reserve was at 568 million barrels. Now, you said it earlier, but strategic means a war or a major crisis where we're going to have potentially our oil cut off. And so Biden now has decided that, I guess, that the cost of gasoline going up requires us to use up a third of our reserves. And by the way, just let me give you some numbers here to show you how crazy this is. Biden wants to give about 1 million barrels per day. Follow me with this. That's about, and he wants to do it for 6 months. So that's about 180 million barrels. Now, the world supply of oil is about 100 million barrels per day, which is about 18 billion barrels over 6 months. So what Biden is doing is introducing about 1% of the needed oil into the market from our strategic reserves. Now, how crazy is that? And he thinks that 1% is going to affect the price of oil? I mean, it's just insane to me that we're, I mean, let's bite the bullet, because 1% isn't going to help us. It did a little bit. It came down $6, I think, when he first announced that he was, you know, going to issue a million barrels per day. But that's just a drop in the bucket compared to the price of, or the amount of oil out there, which, by the way, as you know, sets the price. It's a futures commodity market. And if traders think that it's going to be in short supply in the future, you can bet the price of oil is going to rise. And that's what's happened. Biden wants to blame Putin on this, but it's a supply. It's simple supply and demand. And I know you guys are all economists, so I'm certainly not going to try to tell you what supply and demand is. I think everybody knows what we're dealing with. But the first day Biden was in office, he shut down the Keystone Pipeline. And he also shut down ANWR, which is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and the production there. So it's like, you know, he came in guns blazing, and now he wonders why we have no affordable gasoline. The U.S. oil and gas industry is not only are we efficiently and affordably producing it, but it's the cleanest oil and gas in the world. You know, oil has a lot of sulfur, can have a lot of sulfur in it. Russia is notorious, so is Iran, for the amount of sulfur in their oil. So here we are, we're begging Russia, we were begging Russia, now we're going to go beg Iran to produce more oil so that we can get dirty oil when we were fracking and getting very clean oil. We're now going to be burning oil that has a lot of sulfur in it. What are we thinking? And I really have to say, as a geologist, I'm pulling my hair out. When Biden came into office, he instructed the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is called FERC, to ban all pipelines and the construction of pipelines. So I see Jen Psaki on the news every night going, well, we've got 9,000 leases out there. If they would just produce from those leases, then we wouldn't have anything to worry about. Well, if you shut down all the creation of pipelines where you can't get the oil out once you drill them, well, that's going to put kind of a damper on the oil industry. The Interior Department stopped drilling on all federal lands. They just cut it off. So we're not allowed to drill on any federal lands. An immense amount of oil was coming from our federal lands. And I think the oil companies have been good citizens on those federal lands. They put it all, after they're done drilling and after they're done producing, they put it back to the way, by law, to the way it looked before. And then, I don't know if you know this, but the Energy Department, we froze our liquid natural gas exports. So the Energy Department said you can't do that. Meanwhile, the EPA reinstated stricter standards for drilling. So you've got now Biden doing all this stuff to get to zero carbon emissions in the next 8 years. And we're already seeing the effects on the economy, and he's just getting started. If you want to see, you know, gasoline at the pump at $15, $20 a gallon, just let Biden keep doing what he's doing. Yeah. And one last thing. Sorry, I didn't
mention. No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, just one last thing. I want to get this idea that people have when Psaki says 9,000 leases. Just the other day, Biden said he wants to make the oil companies now pay for the leases they have. Well, what a lot of people don't realize is that a lease is a 10-year contract with the government, and you can either drill if you think there's oil there, or if you don't think there's oil there, you can keep it until maybe the price of oil gets to where you can afford to invest in the infrastructure to get that oil out if you hit it. So, of course, they're not drilling on these leases because the government has stopped us from building pipelines to get the oil out where you drill. They're not, you know, they're not drilling in downtown Washington, D.C. They're drilling out in the middle of nowhere where they need pipelines, they need roads, they need all that infrastructure. And if Biden's not going to permit it, then it's ridiculous to hell, they'll give the leases back to the government because nobody's investing in oil right now because Biden has made it so difficult and expensive to produce oil. So why do it? And you've got companies like BlackRock. Sorry if I'm sounding a little heated here, but BlackRock investments, they refuse to invest unless it's green. So the investment in oil has dropped to zero because – not zero, but very low because Biden has made it so difficult for oil companies to do their drilling. They've even created some – this is the biggest joke. Under the Obama administration, they – have you heard this social cost of carbon?
Yep,
you know what
of
I'm
course.
Talking about?
Yep.
And it's supposed to be how much damage is done by producing a ton of carbon dioxide that's created from the production of carbon. Well, of course, that's the silliest thing in the world. Biden made it $57 per barrel or per ton, I mean, and Trump did $7, and now Biden's got it back up to $51. And it's just magic. No one knows even how carbon dioxide is affecting the entire climate. So this nonsense, they've included forest fires in there. They've included hurricanes. Well, there's no studies now that definitively show that forest fires and hurricanes, large hurricanes, are the result of global warming. It's just fiction. We can't look at it that carefully. The programs that are run, these huge, massive algorithms, just don't have enough data to say, okay, a big hurricane is due to global warming, or all these forest fires are due to global warming. So here we are trying to put this price of the damage being done to the environment at some number. It's pure fiction. And yet those numbers are used to allow somebody like Biden to go out there and shut down everything because he claims that it's going to cost these large amounts of money. I feel like I'm lecturing. I don't mean to do that.
That's why you're here. That's why I want you on the podcast. So don't feel free. Feel free to say whatever you want, and for as long as you want. You know, just to go back to what you said about Biden canceling the pipeline on day one. You know, he did that. Why? He did it because it was a good talking point, right? Because it looked good. It looked like, hey, I'm in the new sheriff in town. I'm making decisions. I'm pro environmentalist. Da 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 da. And that was the first. So he acted completely on, you know, optics there with little regard for what it would actually mean. And that's part, in my opinion, that's part of a bigger problem that we have about entitlement in this country and not understanding the necessity of productive capacity of, you know, what the nation produces, what commodities we have. And we're going to be in the midst of learning a very hard lesson about that now, because, you know, one of the things that Russia has done is they've kind of looked these financial sanctions in the eye and they've said, okay, well, check this out. You know, we've got oil and we've got gold. So we're only going to accept rubles when you want to buy our oil or or gold. And, you know, the market might get a little fucky here for a second, but we're comfortable falling back on our gold reserves. We're comfortable falling back on the nation's productive capacity. And we're comfortable falling back on the fact that we control all this oil. And already you're starting to see strategic, actual strategic. I know we talk about the strategic petroleum reserve, and he's using it like a six-year-old uses a piggy bank. But but we're actually starting to see strategic-looking interest from countries like China, who, of course, would love to buy oil and gas projects that are, you know, Russian and have been killed by the market at a discount. Of course they would like to, you know, have access to these commodities and the productive means to acquire, you know, oil in the future. And so, you know, the market will eventually put a bottom in on the ruble. It'll put a bottom in on Russia's economy. And it seems like the Russians have kind of, you know, shrugged and just said, okay, you know, we're comfortable falling back on our productive capacity. Now, in the U.S., we don't give a shit about productive capacity because we have been in the unique position of having the global reserve currency for the last 40 years to fall back on, which we have fooled ourselves into thinking that we can print whenever we need it. It is the only thing that we export from our country is U.S. dollars, and we import everything in this country from China, you know, from everywhere. We don't really make much in the U.S. anymore. And so, you know, unbeknownst to us, we're in this extraordinarily precarious position that, you know, I wrote last week, it's like trying to balance an elephant on one leg, you know, on a toothpick. And that toothpick is the dollar's reserve status. Because if the U.S. dollar loses reserve status, and demand for the dollar globally starts to wane, and the rest of the world starts to do what Russia is doing and focus on, you know, well, what is tangible there that they can back, you know, their economy or their currency with, we're going to have a huge problem. And so that ethos, that entitlement, that arrogance, that misunderstanding of the basics of, you know, what makes a strong economy and what makes a sound currency that we've gotten away from due to 40 years of monetary policy bullshit that we have, you know, pat ourselves on the back for because we've cloaked it in enough academic circle jerks and jargon to convince ourselves that it's the right answer when it isn't. That is going to be our downfall. And that is why Joe Biden is not considering our energy productive capacity and would rather just, you know, play to the emotions and the feelings of his base. Because, you know, of course, politically for him, it's the right move. But Mark, you know, he's not even thinking in terms of productive capacity for the country in general.
Oh yeah, don't even get me started. And let's take this. By the way, I'm glad you brought up the dollar. China must be loving this because they want to get us. They want to get the world off the dollar. And if I understand correctly, our ability to borrow trillions of dollars is based on the fact that the world will accept the dollar. But you're right. If we can't get people to accept the dollar as a currency, then we aren't going to be able to borrow off of it, if I've understood that correctly. So we are in a serious, serious situation now. And it seems to me that ultimately it probably will be the crash of the dollar that will potentially destroy our American economy. Am I wrong there? Have I misunderstood something?
Nope. I think you are dead on balls accurate. And I write about it, you know, on my blog all the time. It feels like every fucking day I'm writing the same thing. But until the rest of the world or the rest of the nation starts to see, you know, what's interesting is you'd have these guys, and this is a post that I'm writing for next week, but I'll get it out there anyways. You have these guys like, you know, Peter Schiff, for example, all these Austrian economists that realize our nation has been propped up and our quality of life has been propped up by this unique privilege we have of having mm-hmm. the global reserve currency. And, you know, they've been talking about it for years, if not for decades. You know, certainly it's something that over the course of the last decade I've taken exception with. Once I figured out how the system worked, I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me. Really? Like, you know, I think it's something that if everybody understood, the commoners would get up and riot. But I think they don't understand it. And so, but, you know, for years, Austrian economists have pointed this out. They've said, okay, we enjoy this unique privilege. And this is really, like you said, what our entire economy rests on. And if that's ever challenged, or worse, you know, overthrown, it will be a very rude awakening. And for years, you know, people like that were written off, ridiculed. As a matter of fact, I started a podcast because guys like Bill Fleckenstein and Peter Schiff, who I enjoyed listening to, weren't getting airtime on financial news media. And I thought they were making a lot of sense. So for the last decade, as I've, you know, been in this myself, and for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years since I've done the podcast, I've listened to these people get ridiculed, and myself included, by arrogant people in the financial media, by, you know, people in the industry that have based their careers and their understanding of economics and finance in general on assumptions that could very easily be pulled out from underneath them without, you know, without warning. And I've watched these people just kind of be like written off and cast off as, you know, a lot of times people say in finance, Mark, they're broken clocks. You know, they're even a mm-hmm. broken clock is right twice a day. That's the mm-hmm. kind of attitude people have towards these, toward these skeptics. But I have to tell you, we're on the precipice of, unfortunately, many of these people being proven right. And that's going to be a sad and horrifying realization for the country. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, if you've been railing about it for 30 years, or maybe, you know, 40 or 45 years since we've come off the gold standard, and you've been railing about it and warning about it for that long, and the year is 2022, and it looks like, you know, the global economy is finally going to bifurcate in such a way that, you know, Russia, China, India will have, you know, currency and economies backed by things, and the U.S. won't. It's really not that long of a period of time, 45 years for shit to fall apart, you know? And what I would always say is about my own, you know, prognostications and those of the people that I follow is, look, we're on an unprecedented path, and it's not that they're wrong. It's just that they haven't been proven right yet, and that day is going to come. And here we are, you know, we're looking it dead in the eye, Mark. I've said, you know, one of the first blog posts I made last year before all this shit started, I said, China's going to back their digital currency with gold. You know, that hasn't really proven out yet, but I still think it's going to happen. But why did I say that? Because, well, it just made sense that China, if they were going to take the time to introduce a new currency, you're right in knowing, of course, they want to dethrone the dollar, that they would do that. And China and Russia now collectively have been de-dollarizing for the last decade, mm-hmm. you know, building mm-hmm. their gold reserves, stopping yes. transacting in dollars. You know, China still owns a lot of U.S. treasuries.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, you know, they play the long game, and this is something that's been building up. And so we think we're making this, we think we're holding this trump card, Mark, in being able to say, hey, we're going to cut you off from the SWIFT system, thinking, we're really going to do some damage, you know? And Russia and China and India and Saudi Arabia, you know, they're probably like, fuck the SWIFT system, you know? Like, we've got the oil and we've got the gold. You know, keep the SWIFT system and keep passing your fiat currencies back and forth, and we're going to be on some new shit over here. And if you want what we produce in Russia, if you want our oil and gas, or in China, if you want our fucking, you know, party favors or whatever they're making in China, you're going to have to come with some type of currency that means something, that is backed by something. Otherwise, good luck. Good luck with the dollar.
I couldn't agree more. I think I read somewhere this is new monetary theory. You can print as much money as you want, kind of idea.
Modern monetary theory.
Modern monetary, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, there's another angle to all this, of course, and that is that everybody now, they're all talking about driving electric cars. And I'm thinking to myself, well, yeah, but right now, 40% of the electric generation in the U.S. is powered by natural gas. So we may not be burning it in our cars, and I recognize that it is, you get more pollution by having individual cars running around burning gasoline than you do creating it, using it to generate electricity. But there's the thermodynamics law in here, which basically every time you switch from one type of energy to another, you lose energy. So if I'm going to produce my electric energy from gas and then have it run in cars, that is a lot. You get a lot less energy out of that in the long run than you do burning it directly in cars. So I guess what I'm trying to say is we're not getting ourselves off of the need for natural gas by using electric cars. We're just getting and burning natural gas in a different place. And I don't really know if, I mean, do green people realize that, these fanatics?
No.
Do they realize that that's happening? I don't get it.
Of course they don't. I mean, this is like why you see the photographs of, you know, the Tesla plugged into a diesel generator. It's just like, you know, you ever see those pictures? You know, somebody drives their fucking electric car out to, you know, Bonnaroo or some music festival where they're going to, you know, eat a bunch of mushrooms and be one with the environment, you know, which, by the way, I support that. You want to go to a music festival and eat mushrooms. Yeah. I think that's a great idea.
I hear you. But
like, you know, they drive their fucking electric vehicle out to the middle of a field in upstate New York somewhere to, you know, dance around to fish. And then they realize they can't plug the fucking thing in anywhere because there's no power outlets, you know, but they've wheeled out, 15 diesel generators for people to plug their electric vehicles in so that they can recharge them, you know, and drive home. And then you see that picture, right, of the environmentalist with the electric car, you know, full of nickel and cobalt and, you know, plugged into the diesel generator. And you would think, Mark, that would be an aha moment for some people, right? Where does this energy come from? You know, but it's not. No. The same way that people in the United States just think that stuff comes from the sky. You know, the shit in front of them, like we're talking about earlier, people don't understand petroleum's role in the products and, you know, things that we use on an everyday basis. People go to the store and they pick up a fucking can of Chef Boyardee ravioli and they're like, you know, this is always going to be here. This is always on this shelf. It comes from the sky, you know, and anytime I want a ravioli, you know, I have to fucking, I come here and I buy it and it's always available. And they don't realize, you know, that there's chemicals in a plant somewhere where, you know, these things get canned and then they got to get put on a truck and then they got to get shipped somewhere, you know, so this, supply chain crisis that we're having is also waking a lot of people up to the idea that, oh, you know, things don't spontaneously materialize out of thin air. You know, and to be honest with you, not to go on a rant here, but I talked about this years ago, that I think like one of the first times I ever thought about this was I was in a ShopRite in German, or Pathmark. I used to live in Germantown, and there was a Pathmark at Shelton and Wayne that closed, which is, you know, great neighborhood. But they would sell these TV dinners, Mark. These, like, I forget what they were called. They were like Hungry Man or some shit like that. Or like the banquet fucking, you know what I'm talking about? The little frozen.
Yeah, I think I do.
Yeah. So you would go and you'd buy one, and it would be like, you know, and it was always shit food, you know, but it would be like, oh, Salisbury steak with mashed potatoes.
Oh,
and,
I remember
and
those.
Corn,
sure.
Right. And it, you know, it was 99 cents, right? And
right.
I would stand in front of the freezer, and I would be like, "How is it possible that somewhere they're producing this frozen dinner, as shitty as it might be, right, on a little paper plate with plastic wrap on it and a cardboard box, that's being produced somewhere, put on a truck, and makes its way to my Pathmark in Germantown?" And gets sold to me for 99 cents, and somebody is still making money on that. How is that possible? So that got me thinking, like, wow, supply chain, logistics, you know, how does shit get here? People don't think about that stuff, Mark. People have no clue.
Well, and you also mentioned other things, like, you know, you in a car that's electric, you have to have batteries, and those batteries require lithium and rare earth elements, and one of the areas of geochemistry I work in is with rare earth elements. And we used to produce here in the United States a lot of our own rare earth elements. But now we're getting all of our rare earth elements from China. When you talk about supply and demand, finally, I think with COVID, we're starting to realize, you know, that almost everything we needed during COVID from the medical world was being made in China. And so we were in a bad position because we couldn't make it here. So somebody has got to think about, you know, where we're going to get all of these products if we are not willing to depend on foreign countries like China, who are adversaries. Clearly, they are adversaries. They're not nice folks. As we've seen from Putin and him, what he's doing in Ukraine, and then also China with Taiwan. There's no question in my mind that China is willing to go to war over Taiwan. They are waiting. They play the wait game, and they're waiting for the right time, like, say, a weak president. But anyway, it's another story.
Well, what the hell would happen if they went to war with Taiwan right now? I mean, we're already being caught completely... You know, what would happen if that just happened tomorrow? If they just said, okay, now's the time, we're going in.
Well, Biden would do some fierce punishing of the leaders, cutting them off from whatever you do in sanctions. I don't know what would happen. It's a scary thought. Hopefully, this has been a good lesson for those that might want to invade another country, but we'll see. I think that's what China wants. I know we've been talking for an hour here, but let me. Do I have time to talk about one other thing?
Sure, please do.
I just wanted to bring up how I feel as an earth scientist that getting the world to cut back on carbon dioxide to net zero is a fool's errand. I think that. We're never going to be able to get countries that have populations that are on the verge of starving to death to go to clean when it's so much cheaper to burn fossil fuels. So I think what we've got to start thinking about is, number one, technology, and number two, nuclear energy. And of course, China's already beaten us to this. Are you familiar with the new thorium-232 nuclear power plants that China is building?
Am I?
Is your audience familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with them intimately, but, you know, I've written about nuclear and why it seems like a practical solution, and I know that many of my readers and listeners agree with that.
Well, let me just briefly summarize. When you use U-238, which is what has powered our nuclear power plants in the past, it is the uranium-235 that comes with the U-238. But U-235 is what splits, not U-238. So when you produce uranium-238. We're talking about isotopes now. It's only about 1% of the uranium-238 produced has uranium-235. So we have to enrich it, and through the enriching process, U-235 only gets to be about 5% total what we're using. Now, when you split uranium-235 to create energy, you get products that they decay, but they're not super dangerous products. It's the capturing of neutrons by U-238 that creates some real nasty stuff like plutonium and americium. And plutonium is the most poisonous product in the world. In fact, the Russians have used it to kill some of their secret agents that Putin didn't like. And I think they used plutonium to try to kill the leader of the previous leader of Ukraine. Anyway, it's pretty nasty stuff. And when we use U-238 in nuclear power plants, we produce plutonium, which, as I understand it, can be used in nuclear weapons. That's what's used in nuclear weapons. So any country that we allow, like Iran, we're going to build Iran two nuclear power plants if Biden signs this so-called treaty to get more oil from Iran. They're going to be able to produce plutonium from those nuclear power plants that we're building for them. And so we're saying, well, we don't want them to have a bomb. Well, it just seems then insane that we're helping them build. Anyway, I'm getting off the subject. What I want to do is to tell you about thorium-232.
Well, you can stay on your Iran thread, though, because you said to me in your email to me that I wrote out as an article, and I want to read it, and then we'll go on to the thorium thing. We have plenty of time, but you wrote, you know, perhaps the most irrational decision ever made by a president is Biden's pursuit of the Iranian and Venezuelan nuclear deal to get access to Iran's oil. They are the foremost sponsor of terrorism in the world, and yet we're willing to sign a very one-sided treaty with them to gain oil, which is extremely dirty. So just looping back to reiterate the point we just made about, you know, producing here in the U.S., it puts us in a very weak position. It is so stupid to cut off supply here so that we can go and negotiate with Iranians to get the same shit we could be producing here at home. Sorry, I just wanted to make that point because I know you had written about
it. No, thank you for making it. In fact, I think I said it was batshit crazy, if I remember.
Those were the words you used, yes.
And I guess I apologize for using words like that, but by golly, it's true. And I don't know why the Greens don't, radical environmentalists don't understand this, are willing to, you know, make a terrorist organization that is Iran and give them free nuclear power plants or help them build nuclear power plants, which help them then generate nuclear weapons. It's just beyond my comprehension as to what kind of fools we must be dealing with because they somehow think that we've got to stop carbon dioxide tomorrow. And yet here we are cutting back on our own oil production and then turning around and buying it from Iran. I mean,
you don't have to be playing four-dimensional chess. You don't have to be playing 4D chess. All you have to do is just think things through, to the next iteration, you know, like a fourth grader would.
No kidding.
You know, okay.
Or going to Venezuela and begging the socialist government to give us oil.
Right. We're not going to supply ourselves with oil. So maybe, you know, the environmentalists should ask themselves, well, where's it going to come from? Ah, you know, but that's a, you know.
But how is it better to get it from a communist nation or a terrorist nation than it is to produce it in your own backyard?
It's not. That's a great question for AOC.
Right. We're not. It's not like all of a sudden oil is going to be stopped producing. We're still going to be using the same amount of oil. We're just getting it from different places. Why not get it from the U.S.? It's cleaner. It's better. It's cheaper. Ah, it gets me pulling my hair out. Well, just let me briefly finish this by mentioning the thorium-232.
Sure.
So thorium-232, the great thing about that is that now it does take some processing, but thorium in abundance is about three times more abundant than uranium. And thorium comes out pure. We can get thorium-232, which is pure. It's not like we're going to get a lot of byproducts like we do with U-238. When 95% of the stuff you're using when you use U-238 is converted to nasty radioactive elements, you shouldn't be using U-238. But using thorium-232, which is eventually converted to pure uranium-233, then you can get nuclear power without having all of the nasty byproducts that you get when you use uranium-238. So I think, unfortunately, I'm afraid that nuclear energy, even though it might be our savior in terms of global warming, because when you use thorium-232, not only are you not getting any radioactive dangerous products, but you're also not polluting the atmosphere with carbon dioxide. Unfortunately, nuclear energy has gotten such a bad rep because of things like Chernobyl or Fukushima. Fukushima and of course our own Three Mile Island. I'm just afraid the Greens are never going to let nuclear energy start. So what's ultimately the end game here? If you can't do nuclear energy, which is clean, and you can't do and CO2, getting people to stop using fossil fuels to reduce CO2, what can you do? I think the only other answer is technology, creating umbrellas possibly, or you know, some crazy shit like that. Because environmentalists will never, it seems to me, allow a nuclear. The final thing probably to say in all this is that you've got people that are forcing our economy to take the hit ultimately by forcing us to use electric cars and all those kinds of things, and making us more dependent on China and Arab oil and so on and so forth. So if we can't do it, you can't make a radical environmentalist happy. How about what's going on with the wind farms? People now are complaining about the noises. They're complaining about the birds, the number of birds they kill. The same thing's happening with solar energy. You put a field of solar panels out, you can't grow on that. So the environmentalists are never going to be happy. They'll find something to complain about. They're very negative people. the only way you're going to make them happy is if all of us kill ourselves, and then the planet can go back to the way it was. I have no patience with them.
Well, so, I'm optimistic that nuclear is going to play a role going forward, because it exists in the middle of this Venn diagram between unrealistic energy expectations on both sides of the oil, of the aisle, of the oil. Hey, you know, I feel like nuclear is such a practical solution because you can generate enormous amounts of energy and the carbon footprint is low, that I just feel like we're going to land there. And a lot of the European nations are already landing there. You know, a lot of European nations are already starting to look at these like small reactors. I forget what small module reactors, I think they're called.
Yes.
You know, Macron said that he's looking at them. Poland, I think, is looking at them.
Germany.
Yeah. Yes. Well, Germany, I think, has plants that they were going to decommission that I think that they're extending for a little bit, but they're still on a larger path to decommissioning their nuclear plants. So I think Germany is pulling up the rear. But yeah, to me, it just makes so much sense, nuclear.
Well, guess who has the only thorium-producing nuclear plant being constructed in the world?
George W. Bush.
No, China. They are on their way to constructing thorium-232.
Okay.
So the Chinese know what clean energy is. And here's a country that doesn't have a lot of extremists trying to stop them, so they can do what they want. And
right.
They have decided that the clean energy is the way to go.
Yep.
But let's do it through nuclear energy. Yep. My wife just pointed out to me that, you know, these solar panels also destroy a lot of animal habitat. So, you know, after we get on this clean energy, then they're going to be bitching about the clean energy. And, you know, eventually we'll probably have to come up with some new thing to clean energy. So it's never going to end. Never.
No, it isn't. It isn't. And, you know, good news is we don't have to stay along for the ride for, you know, too much longer, Mark. You know, a couple more decades and then we'll check out and leave the misery to somebody else, unfortunately.
Yeah, I guess so.
But
well.
But listen, thanks so much for coming on and offering your, not to end on a fucking optimistic note there. We'll all be dead soon. Thank you.
You know, well, I'm an optimist. We will be dead, but hopefully our children and grandchildren will be a little better off because
right. We're
making sense of what we're saying.
That's true. That's true. And I think, you know, between that and your comment about the only way environmentalists will be happy is if we all kill ourselves. You know, I think
they do. They want that.
End on a nice optimistic note. But listen, thanks so much for
thank you
for coming on. Let's do it again.
Really enjoyed
very
it.
Soon. I'm sure we'll have
no
shortage of nonsense to talk about as our efficient government continues to react deftly to the energy challenges that we face. And if you have a shout out to a blog or any kind of thing that you want people to go to, you can shout that out now if you'd like.
All right. Well, I enjoyed it, Chris. Thanks very much.
All right. All right, Mark. Thanks so much. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. I don't know if he knew I was asking him to promote himself there at the end, but I'll put his blog link in my profile in the podcast description. And that's that. All right, fools. Villanova's playing tonight. So I'm getting out of here. It's been real. Happy to be back. Thanks so much for listening. I got shit to do. Peace.